In this part of Focus 580, we'll be taking a look at where things stand now with our knowledge of the human genome and what that will mean for medicine and human health. And our guest for the program is Nicholas Wade. He is a reporter for The New York Times. He has been an editorial writer, a science editor, and now he's a science reporter. He has been author or co-author of a number of books and has one out now, which is titled Life Script. And the subtitle is How the Human Genome Discoveries Will Transform Medicine and Enhance Your Health. It's published by Simon & Schuster and is out now in bookstores if you want to look at it. And questions and comments, of course, on this program are welcome. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number. If you're here in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, you're anywhere around Illinois or over in Indiana or any place the signal will travel, you can use that number. That's 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. At any point you have questions, you can call. Mr. Wade, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for inviting me on the show.
Just to start it as a very basic sort of way to start, we now talk about the fact that we have this map of the human genetic material. At the same time, it's from some of what I read, saying that we have the map of the material is one thing, but saying that we actually understand how it works is something else. What, at this point, what actually is it that we do know?
Well, what we have at present is just the sequence of DNA units, all 3 billion of them. And we don't even quite have all that. We've got them in bits and pieces, but we've got the vast majority of the 3 billion unit code that the cell needs for running and operating a human being. The next task is to try and find out where the genes are, which is not at all obvious, and then what each gene does. And when we know that, then we'll have a full parts list of the human body.
Hmm. That, not to take anything away from what has been achieved so far, but it sounds as if really we're the more important information, or the more potentially useful information is yet ahead of us.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. This is just the first step. I mean, it's quite an important one, and it's surprising we've reached that point so soon, but still the vast bulk of the work lies ahead.
Mm-hmm. How, and I know that as you just touched on the fact that the projected target date for this work being completed, I don't recall now when it is. I think that actually it's still in the future, and that, as you say, the work was done much more quickly than anyone expected. What was it that made it possible for this to be accomplished more quickly than we thought it would?
I think it was the growing advance in the DNA sequencing machines. Which sort of like computers, the power of computing gets sort of cheaper every year. Each model of DNA sequencing machine got better and more powerful. And the most recent model was one that allowed the whole process of DNA sequencing or DNA decoding to go much more cheaply and economically than before. And it's that that allowed a competitor, the Celera Genomics Corporation, to leap into the race with the consortium of universities who had started the Human Genome Project some 12 years previously.
Mm. So it mostly was a hardware issue then?
That was a major component, and another, I guess, was the software, and just people learnt... people learned to be much more efficient in interpreting the results of the machine. The machines can only analyze little snippets of DNA that are sort of 500 bases. So you produce millions and millions of these little 500 base runs that you have to sort of piece together. And that's a very difficult task that the sequencing teams got better and better at.
How much longer do we think that it will take to make this next step that we were talking about a moment ago, that is to get a complete understanding of essentially what part of the genome does what?
Well, I think most people you talk to will say it's going to be the work of decades. Right now, we don't even know how many genes there are in the human genome. The best guess at present is 30,000, but I think that number is likely to go up. So each of those 30,000 or more genes needs to be discovered. Its sequence needs to be discovered on the genome, and then scientists need to find out exactly what the gene does in the cell and how it interacts with other genes, and the role it plays in human lifespan and health. So all that is just going to take a very long time, I think, unless some sort of unexpected method arrives of studying genes en masse.
Mm-hmm. One of the surprises that came out of this work was that has to do with this number of genes. For some other living things, we had that number, and perhaps this was a case of hubris. I don't know. We said, well, human beings, they're so much more complicated than these other creatures, so we ought to have many more genes than they. And as it turns out, that's the number, the estimates of how many genes human beings had turned out to be much more than apparently it actually is, which brought us down to Earth a little bit more. But is that, I wonder what the significance of that that discovery is, other than the fact that maybe indeed it suggests that we were thinking a little too highly of ourselves.
Yeah, the first estimate of 100,000 genes was just a sort of guess before anyone knew the structure of genes, on how genes were organized on the genome. It just was a sort of reasonable round number. I think people have sort of overshot. They've gone to the other extreme in saying 30,000, and I think that particularly because just recently, 2 weeks ago, someone published a paper showing for the first time that the two sets of genes that we have from the public consortium and from Celera, which sort of seem both to agree on this number of 30,000, in fact, they're not looking at the same set of 30,000 genes. The new study showed that they overlap to the extent of only about 50%. So the other 50% that each side is seeing is not present in the other side's set. So that could suggest right away that that we may have as many as 45,000 genes. And it also suggests something else, which is how little we know about how to locate genes on the genome.
Hmm. And also, there is not the case that there's also material there that, as far as we know, doesn't do anything, or right now that it doesn't do anything.
That's right. A lot of the genome is what is often called junk, and some people say that's the wrong term. We don't really know what it does other than that it does not code for genes. But the more we look at it, the more it does seem to be junk. It seems to be various sort of genes that whose replication just got out of control, and like a sort of parasitic virus, it kept multiplying and just clogging up the genome. But all this happened quite some time ago, so the stuff doesn't do us very much harm. It just sort of sits there, but it has no function in that it's not translated into proteins and doesn't do very much else. So when you've accounted for the parts of the genome that are actually protein coding genes, plus the sort of control sequences that tell the cell's translation machinery sort of start here, there's a gene ahead, all that seems to amount to just about 3% or less of the 3 billion bases in the genome.
We're talking in this part of Focus 580 with Nicholas Wade. He's a science writer for the New York Times and is the author of a recently published book that looks at just the very matter that we were talking about here this morning, how it is that the human genetic material came to be decoded to the extent that it has, and what that means for medicine. His book is titled Life Script, and it's published by Simon & Schuster, the subtitle, How the Human Genome Discoveries Will Transform Medicine and Enhance Your Health. And we do have a caller, and other people are certainly welcome to call if you have questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have two questions. They may actually be related. First one is, given that they haven't finished doing the entire sequencing, what was the milestone that these two organizations were celebrating as finishing? Was it that they were simply not interested in the last few bits of sequencing? And if so, what was the criteria for deciding what was important and what wasn't in that calculation? And then secondly, this, given that there's variation in genetics between one human being and another, what were they sequencing? Were they sequencing a particular individual or some sort of average of the population or what?
Those are two good questions. The milestone that led to the White House announcement in June of last year was that the public consortium reckoned it had done 90% of the genome. That is, that it had got 90% of the genome, although in bits and pieces, actually decoded and posted on the computer database that everyone can access. And since it decided to hold a joint announcement with its rival Celera, Celera also sort of claimed victory. And I've forgotten exactly what Celera's claim was, but the bottom line is that both teams at that stage had most but not all of the genome in their computers.
So they just decided to declare that the finish line, and so they'd have something to announce.
Yes, it was a little more complicated than that, and they were both in a sort of race to see who could finish first. And I think they both figured, or it was forcibly brought to their attention by others, that it would be they'd be much better off if they had a joint declaration of victory, rather than each announcing victory separately, along with sort of criticisms of the quality of the other's work.
Uh-huh.
So it was a sort of it was a grand political compromise, and it was a little premature, since as is implied in your question, it was not really a clear finishing line. It was not a scientifically valid finishing line. They hadn't got anywhere near the 100% of the genome, which was what they were originally shooting for.
And about the variation?
Well, each of them was looking at the DNA of a few individuals, and they did it in slightly different ways. The NIH, the public consortium, had led by the National Institutes of Health, had, as I remember, about 10 anonymous individuals. And their genome is a sort of mosaic in that as you go along it, one section is from individual A and the next from individual B and then individual A again. So it's a sort of mosaic of different people. And it's a rather sort of odd hybrid chimeric affair. Whereas the Celera genome is from five individuals of, I think it's five, of the sort of four major ethnic divisions of humankind, African-American, Caucasian,
mm-hmm.
Asian, the three major divisions, I should say. But most of Celera's comes from a single individual who is, I think, who has not also not been identified.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. We'll go on to another caller here. This is on our line number two.
Yes. I have a question about the profit motive for Celera. It's very expensive and costly, and I'm sure the investors in that company expect to reap benefits. And I wonder if you would describe what benefits they're expecting to reap, and also the question of, you know, can't indeed this information in our bodies be copyrighted or whatever it is they do to get a lock and to make money?
Well, Solaria's business plan is kind of unusual in that they are hoping to make money as a database. So they have their human genome online, along with the mouse genome, which is a very useful tool for trying to interpret the human genome, and various other genomes. And they charge subscriptions to universities and drug companies who want to access the data. Now, the subscription price is set quite low, and that's partly because everyone has an alternative, which is for free, because the public consortium makes its genome data available for free. So Solaria's business plan is to sort of try and be a little better than the public data, to have sort of better online tools for searching the genome and trying to make sense of it. And the mouse in particular is the ace up their sleeve. So how well Solaria is doing, I don't know, but that is how they hope to make money.
And what is a subscription fee, if you know?
It hasn't been published exactly, but as I recall, it's something like sort of $10,000 to $15,000 per researcher per year. So that's sort of mostly covered by their grant money. It's probably not outrageous if you compare it, I don't know, say, to a learned journal subscription, some of which can reach easily sort of $1,000 a year. So given the interest of the human genome, a subscription fee of sort of $10,000 is probably within the realm of what people would consider reasonable.
So have they copyrighted this, and do they have a right to copyright it? To just put something on the internet and charge a fee, that, you know, doesn't seem outrageous to me. But can they actually get a copyright on this?
I don't think copyright applies, because it's not a work it's not a sort of literary work. But patents do apply, and people who search through their sequence can apply for a patent on any discovery they make, as can Solaria. Solaria also is looking for genes of medical interest, and has said it will try and patent a certain number of them, I think like 100 or so, but it's not trying to patent the whole human genome.
And the federal government is allowing them to patent this?
It does sound a little odd that people can patent the human genome or any
really?
Part of it, but the courts have held that things found in nature can be patented, and often what is patented is not the thing itself, but rather the process for isolating it or for manufacturing it. It certainly, I think the view of the patent courts is that this should be like any other patent. You want to encourage an inventor or discoverer to take the risk of bringing something to market, and the conditions are that the inventor should make the invention public so everyone else can try and make use of it too in some way. And of course, the patent only lasts for a limited time. I believe it's 17 years now. So. Every patent expires in due course.
Yes, except that the drug companies have managed to put a lock on a lot of things that they patented that come from nature, and subsequently, pharmacy bills are just, skyrocketed over the last several years. So the federal courts do say that this can be patented. What effects will this have then on medicine, not medical research, but medicine? Does that mean down the road, doctors would have to pay patent fees in order to prescribe things?
No, I think it just means that a pharmaceutical company that finds some very useful a hormone or signaling factor in the human genome will sort of patent that and sell it as a patented drug. So, of course, if they're the only ones in the market, they can charge a very high price as long as their patent lasts. So that is, unfortunately, the reason why the price of medicines is so high. A patent, after all, is a legal monopoly, and high prices go along with that. I guess the other side of it is that one gets the advantage of drugs that otherwise might not have been discovered or discovered so soon if you didn't offer this enormous incentive to people.
Okay. excuse me. I will hang up, and if you might talk about what implications there are for future future effects on healthcare, I would find that very interesting, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, let me just real quick here for the benefit of people who might have been listening for a little bit here, and as we are at the midpoint, I want to introduce again the guest. We're speaking with Nicholas Wade. He works for The New York Times. He has been an editorial writer, a science writer, and now he is he's been a science editor, and now he's a science reporter. And he has been the author or co-author of a number of books. And if you're interested in reading on this subject, he has one that's out now that's titled Life Script: How the Human Genome Discoveries Will Transform Medicine and Enhance Your Health. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And questions are welcome, 333-WILL or 9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Well, indeed, the very question is, what really are the implications, as you suggest in the subtitle, what are the implications of this for medicine and for human health? What is it, once we get to that point when we really do have a more complete understanding of the human genetic material and how it works, what is it that we think we're going to be able to do?
I think overall the goal should be that we will learn how to repair the body with its own repair mechanisms, the ones that are implicit in the information coded in the genome. And I think when we arrive at that point, we will look back perhaps with a certain degree of horror at the crudity of the methods we use right now, the knives and scalpels of surgery and the sort of strong toxic chemicals that are our present set of drugs, because by far the best way to repair the body is through the use of cells and the signals to which the cells respond. And at present, we are very ignorant about those. But already, the first sort of wave of drugs based on those signals is in clinical trials. And one of the most interesting is a protein with the long name of keratinocyte growth factor 2, or KGF2, and this has been discovered to be one of the sort of master signals the body uses to repair wounds. So if you just apply that signal, that protein molecule, to wounds that have been very slow to heal, like ulcers, it does seem in many cases to have a remarkable effect in sort of mobilizing the tissue repair mechanisms that, for whatever reason, were failing to close that wound. So I think that and stem cells, the signaling factors and the stem cells are going to be two ingredients in what people are calling regenerative medicine, meaning medicine that seeks to repair the body by regrowing an organ or a tissue.
I think that in the popular imagination, that what people fix on is this idea that we know that there are many diseases that have a genetic component. Perhaps we don't understand completely exactly how that works and how genes and environment interact, but we do have this idea that things like diabetes and some cancers and heart disease and perhaps Alzheimer's disease and a number of things do indeed have these genetic components. And if somehow we could understand where those genes were and how they worked, that we could develop a kind of therapy that perhaps early in a person's life before these problems actually developed, that we could identify that they were at risk of a particular condition and then modify their genetic material so that essentially we were, if they had a genetic tendency to develop a disease, we could turn that off. And that's, I think, what people often think about when they hear this notion that we're decoding the genome and we're trying to understand genes and disease and we're going to develop therapies. Is that something that it's actually reasonable to expect that we will be able to do within, who knows, within 40, 50 years, more or less? Is it reasonable to think that such a thing, the day will come when such a thing is possible?
I think it's reasonable to assume that at least part of that program will be fulfilled within the next few years, 5 to 10 years maybe. And by the first part, I mean at least we'll get around to identifying the variant genes that underlie a person's susceptibility to diabetes or cancer. We've already gotten pretty good at identifying genes in diseases where you just get a single gene is wrong and the disease results, like sickle cell anemia, for example. The diseases like diabetes and cancer seem in most cases to be caused not by a single gene but by several variant genes acting together. And those are much harder to pinpoint, but the hope is that we will be able to pinpoint them. Once we've done that, I think the first step is that for the first time we will understand diabetes and cancer at a very fundamental level. And from that understanding, we will have a chance to develop drugs, say, or vaccines that interfere in the disease-causing process and arrest it. So that is sort of step one of the program, and it seems to me that it'd be quite reasonable to hope, one or two of the major diseases will succumb to that approach within the foreseeable future. I guess step two would be some kind of genetic engineering, and that is definitely much more futuristic. But if one could identify a list of gene variants that predispose someone to disease, at least for the sort of common, the major diseases, especially the degenerative diseases of age or life, supposing you came up with a handful of such variant genes, it definitely be very tempting to try and correct them in the whole population, thereby sort of delivering a lifetime of medical care at or shortly after conception.
And there are people who would say, I can't tell you when that will happen, but I will tell you that it will?
I think there are people who will say that the first part is definitely possible, identifying the genes that underlie the disease and hoping to, at least you've got a rational basis for devising some kind of therapy. So for the first time, the genome gives you a rational approach to tackling every disease. Now, the second part, genetic engineering, comes in a quite different category because there are major ethical problems requiring a significant sort of discussion and debate and social decisions on whether we wish to go the genetic engineering route. That, after all, is sort of altering the human germline and is not a step to be taken lightly, if at all. It may be we'll decide we don't want to go that route, whatever the benefits. But if we do, then I think at some stage it will become technically possible. There are not a lot of people saying, yes, we definitely can do that. It's a subject many biologists don't like to talk about very much because it's so controversial and also it's a little premature. We haven't gotten there yet. But I think that the day will come eventually when at least we discuss that issue very carefully.
Mm-hmm. And here, I guess, to make sure people understand the sort of last comment you made, there are two ways of approaching this. There is the idea that if an individual, we knew that individual was going to develop a disease, we could see to it that individual, we could fix that so that individual would not develop that disease. That's sort of one, doing it on one level. There would be another level that would say, if this is a disease that is passed on from parents to children, that we could do something that would make sure not only would that individual not get the disease, but that person's descendants would not get that disease. That's something else entirely, and that's where perhaps the question comes up. Do you want to do this just for that person, or do you want to say, for all human beings forever, we're going to do this? And that that raises many more difficult questions, I guess, particularly the question of unforeseen consequences. What might, for making a change like that forever after, what sort of things might follow down the road that we would not anticipate?
I think that's right. That's a very good way of putting it.
We have, I think we're getting another caller here up to talk with us. If you have questions, comments, you want to be involved in the conversation, you can do that very easily by picking up the telephone and calling. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-WILL. We do have a caller here on our toll-free line, our line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
This is a most interesting program, and I thank you for it. In this genetic engineering, why isn't there the talk about a cure for cancer? I never hear that brought up, or maybe I haven't heard it.
That's a good question. I think it's because cancer is such a difficult disease to tackle. And really, it's a sort of it's a set of some 90 or 100 different diseases, and each one, it seems, is going to have to be tackled separately. So we've had some success with a few cancers. Unfortunately, it tends to be the less common ones, and scientists are still sort of largely baffled by the ones that remain. What they do know is that cancer is really a genetic disease. Something goes wrong with the genes that operate and control a cell, and the genes that are there to restrain a cell's growth are somehow sort of sabotaged by the cancer, and various other things go wrong. So fixing a cell at the genetic level is something that we can't quite do right yet, but scientists have been sort of making some progress. They have sort of very deep insights into what does go wrong, which we're just quite a long way from being able to fix it. So I think many people who've claimed to have a cure for cancer found they've disappointed their patients and themselves. So I think scientists are quite rightly very very cautious in saying they have a good treatment. And they just avoid saying they have a cure, because right now it's just simply not the case, except in very rare exceptions.
Well, I have a cousin dying from it, and I have a friend that 40 that died from liver cancer. So when I go to the wake tonight,
I'm sorry to hear it. can just hope that a cure will come eventually. I'm sorry.
It's so prevalent. Thank you much.
Very good. Thank you for the call. Let's continue here. We have another person here on line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was listening on my car radio, and unfortunately I don't get your station in my house because I live in Indiana. My wife has pyoderma gangliosum, which is an ulcer she's had for about 5 years on her ankle from a trauma. And did I understand correctly what you said, that they are able to now trigger the mechanisms for healing, or is it something that we're still looking at in the future?
This is a drug, a protein that is in clinical trials. It's not yet on the market. I don't know if it's recommended for the specific kind of ulcer your wife has. I just know that it's recommended in general for wounds that won't heal.
Who would I contact to find some information on it?
It's made by a company called Human Genome Sciences in Rockville, Maryland. And if you call them or look them up on the web, you may be able to find out how you could enroll in clinical trials. I don't know if they have a clinical trial open, but often you can enroll in these trials. And as long as you're aware that it's an experimental drug that has not yet been
after
approved, they
will. 5 years, she's liable to try anything. So.
Right.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you. And I enjoy the show. It's always been very informative. Thank you.
Great. Well, thanks very much for the call.
Bye.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Nicholas Wade. He's a science writer for The New York Times. His book is Life Script, How the Human Genome Discoveries Will Transform Medicine and Enhance Your Health. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It's in bookstores now if you would like to read it. And if you'd like to ask a question, you can do that here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. I wonder if we might just talk for a little bit here about stem cells.
Right.
They are, in a sense, I suppose it's different, and yet in it's related. And I guess my feeling is that, and maybe I just speak for myself, that as much attention has been paid to the issue of stem cell research in the media recently, I'm not certain that I have a very good understanding about what it is exactly that we're talking about. So maybe we could talk in a very basic way about stem cells and what they are and what we think that this research will make it possible for us to do.
Well, the stem cells are a special class of cells in the body that are used to repair the tissues. Your skin, for example, replaces itself every 2 weeks because of all the wear and tear on the skin. So in the basement layer of the skin, there are special cells, stem cells they're called, that keep generating new cells that provide all those new skin cells you need. And the same for all the blood cells. The average red blood cell lasts only 6 weeks before it gets knocked to pieces struggling through those tiny capillary veins in the body. So those two have to be replaced from blood stem cells that live in the bone marrow. It's taken us a very long time to identify these stem cells because they don't look very different from other cells, and they're very rare, so it's quite hard to find them. And we're still just learning how to control them, in other words, the sort of signals to which they respond. But the sort of the great hope is that if we could find the stem cells that repair each tissue of the body, and it seems that maybe each tissue and organ has its own secret supply of stem cells, if we could find those stem cells and learn how to control them, then we would be able to repair a person's body with their own stem cells in a very novel and efficient way.
Hmm.
So maybe I should make another distinction. The stem cells I've just been talking about are what's called adult stem cells. Those are the stem cells of the adult body. There's another kind called embryonic stem cells, and those are the ones that are created in the human egg of a few days after conception. And it's from those embryonic stem cells, there are about 30 of them, that all the tissues of the body are eventually derived. And scientists also hope to work on those as well. They're much more versatile and easy to grow than the adult stem cells. And the hope is to find the signals that make an embryonic stem cell morph into each of the different tissues, into heart tissue or lung or kidney or whatever. And then you could have a sort of general way of growing up replacement tissues for a patient who needed anything replaced for whatever reason.
Hmm.
We've only taken the first step toward that, but it's just a very new and interesting area of biology.
So there, we actually are thinking about the possibility that, for example, if we had someone who had kidney disease, we had to remove one of their kidneys, that if we understood this mechanism, we could then take these embryonic stem cells, and if we knew how, we could say to them, okay, be a kidney. It would grow into one, and then we would be able to take that and transplant it into this individual who had lost one?
That's right. It's not quite so fantastic as it sounds, because one thing we do know is that the body is designed as a self-assembling system. So if you put these stem cells in the right context with the right sort of cells as their neighbors, they will take up the cues, that the signals are sent out by the neighboring cells, and they will behave accordingly. So if you put a stem cell in the heart, say, it will pick up cues that say, well, you should be a heart muscle, and it will turn into a heart muscle. So even though we've got no idea how to build a heart, nonetheless, the embryonic stem cells could be a kind of, you know, universal clay. Well, it is the clay of which the body is made. But if we mold it just a little, if we learn how to drive those embryonic stem cells down the line of development, the sort of lineage toward being a heart muscle, maybe it won't be necessary to get them actually to the final stage, but just toward that stage. And then you would put them into the heart of someone who had had a heart attack, say, and they would grow into heart muscle cells and replace the damaged tissue. That is the hope. It's been done in mice, so that at least is some kind of proof of principle. A long way yet to go before it's ready to be done in humans, but it's certainly worth looking into. Mm.
And this would get us around the problem when we do a transplant. If we give somebody a kidney, for example, that came from someone else, that person's body will in effect look at that kidney and say, hey, this doesn't belong to me.
Right, that's a very important point. If you're using the adult stem cells that you've taken from the patient himself, you don't have that problem of immune rejection, because you would be repairing him with his own tissue. But you do have the problem if you're using embryonic stem cells. So there are various sort of clever schemes of getting around that. One is to do what they call a co-transplant, in that, first of all, you take a bank of embryonic stem cells and you divide it into two, and one part you would turn into blood stem cells, and you would give the person essentially a bone marrow transplant. They'd have they'd have bone marrow from these embryonic stem cells, and that would induce immune tolerance. So the body then accepts these foreign the blood-forming stem cells as its own. Once you've done that, you can then take your other batch of stem cells and make them into a kidney, say, and implant those kidney cells, and they will be accepted by the body as its own. That's just one way, one idea of how you could overcome the problem of immune rejection. Hmm.
We have time. We have one more caller here, and time for that person, and we'll go to our toll-free line again here, line four. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask just the question that David asked, but let me add to what you've just said. You have just said that you have to, when you use embryonic stem cells to regenerate a given tissue, you have to go through quite a considerable procedure in order to keep the body, which is going to receive that tissue. You have to go through quite a procedure to keep that body from rejecting the tissue that was made from the embryonic stem cell. But you have just said that if you can manufacture that same tissue from the adult stem cell of the person you're trying to treat, you don't have any immune response problem at all. You've eliminated the immune response problem. So why isn't the logical procedure to try to generate the organs from the adult stem cells instead of the embryonic stem cells, in order to avoid the immune response?
Well, scientists are trying to follow both routes. They don't know which procedure is going to be better. There are some disadvantages with the adult stem cells. It's quite hard to grow them in culture. In fact, right now, no one can do that. Whereas the embryonic stem cells, it's very easy to make as many of them as you need. So now, if we can learn how to grow up the adult stem cells in culture and make as many of them as we can, that probably would be the better way to go. But we don't know yet. And right now, I think well, scientists want to try and explore both kinds and see which is better.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We're almost at the point here that we're going to have to finish up. Any last sort of thought that you'd like to leave folks with?
Well, I think just that it's a very interesting area of biology. We've spent the last sort of 20, 30 years making these very powerful tools, and we're just putting them to use. And I think it's going to be a very exciting few years ahead. And the better informed people are about biology and medicine and the genome and stem cells and the rest, the better quality of ethical decision I think we're going to make when it comes to questions of whether we want to use genetic engineering and other problems that are going to come along. Hmm.
Well, I'm sure it's a topic we'll come back to again on other programs. For the moment, though, we want to say, Mr. Wade, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Our guest, Nicholas Wade, he is a science writer for the New York Times. And if you are interested in reading some more on the subject, you can look for his book. It's titled Life Script, How the Human Genome Discoveries Will Transform Medicine and Enhance Your Health, published by Simon & Schuster.